for the week of April 17th, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 318, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Finally in Los Angeles, finally. And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Yes, I am finally back in Los Angeles after a
Alaska, CinemaCon, Mexico. Are we having a show next week?
As far as I know, yes.
Well, you're the only stumbling block.
Yes, I have been really way too busy lately.
Summer hasn't even begun.
I know. I'm actually not looking forward to that. Not looking forward to summer. That should tell you how busy I have been. And yet I look back and wonder, what have I been up to?
And now you're back.
I am back. And prepared and ready to do the show that you have actually prepared for us, because I have been traveling so much, you put the show together this week.
That's right. And what will we be discussing on this week's show?
Well, Michael, as you just mentioned, I've been traveling a lot for work, really. And on this week's show, we'll get the lowdown on CinemaCon, because I was there, and that's why we didn't have a show last week. Oh my God, you know, this is what happens when you don't read the copy before you start speaking.
It starts to make fun of you.
Yes. So now, by the way, I need to justify my attendance at that show, Michael, because if we talk about it on this show, on Showbiz Sandbox, maybe I can make the whole trip a tax write-off. See what I'm doing there?
I do.
We'll also look at the lineup of the Cannes Film Festival, because it's jam-packed with big names and is sure to annoy Michael, since, you know, he's not going this year. And to annoy Michael even more, I'll talk about all the great musical acts I saw at Coachella, which, of course, is the annual music festival here in Southern California. During Inside Baseball, we'll tackle the growing controversy over acting workshops. Those are the educational, and I say that loosely, those are the workshops where actors get pointers on how to audition, but for most people, it feels like scams where struggling actors are conned into paying to audition in front of industry players. Now, with a top casting director losing their job over the practice, it's become a hot-button issue. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, I'm a little busy right now because I'm actually catching up on Archer, thanks to all the people who contacted me both via Twitter and email and phone to tell me, hey, if you want to find out where a show's playing, try the Just Watch app. And they direct message me. And if you want to contact me and Sperling and the show, how would they do that?
Well, we are on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, our username on Twitter. You can search for us on Facebook, where our page should come up. It's Showbiz Sandbox, and our page will be there, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
That's right. And Just Watch is cool. It basically lists all like 10 or 12 or 15 streaming services and tells you what's playing on what. But it's not really what I was looking for. Like when I'm looking for Archer, I want to know, can I go to the FX or the FFX website and find it there? Is it on DVD? Is it on, you know, I want to know everything. So it's a good step forward. It's definitely useful, especially if you have multiple streaming services like Hulu and Amazon and Netflix and all that. But it's not exactly what I'm dreaming of, which is a really universal source for information. You've got a TV show, where can it be watched? When's the next airing a new episode? Where can you download? Where can you watch reruns? Where can you buy it? Where can you stream it? Everything, not just, you know, the streaming services, but the network websites. Maybe the show is a website. Maybe it's on DVD. So there's a lot more that I want that's not on there. So that's where it's at. But we are talking about the weekend's box office, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And, you know, Jungle Book came in at the top, earning $239 million internationally.
Or as I like to call it, $240
million. $240 million. And I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I watched part of it on the plane. Going to and from Las Vegas and CinemaCon. And I really liked the part
where... How did you watch it on the plane?
Well, you know, I put it on my iPad there, you know, my own personal cinema. And I loved the part, the Bare Necessities. I loved it when that bear sang that song.
Oh, God almighty. All right. Okay, yeah. So this is a live-action version directed by Jon Favreau. It's not the classic Disney animated film. This is like the latest Disney movie based on one of their animated classics. It's not really. It's kind of a very different movie. I think they do actually have two songs in it, though they must be shoehorned in there. Because it's sort of basically an action-adventure film with a little boy and a lot of animatronics or whatever the latest technology is.
Animatronics? That would be like, you know, 1960s
that's
technology.
The Hall of Presidents, yeah. So it's basically a big, flashy action film for families.
Yes.
It has very little to do with the actual books, by the way, but I guess that's another story. I actually love the books. I think it's terrific, but that's another story. $240 million worldwide. It's total of $290 million because I guess it opened up on Wednesday or a weekend earlier in some territories. One of the two big things about this movie, tracking again way off. In North America, they said it would open to about $65 million, $67, $68 million. That was a day before it opened, and it ended up being 50% higher than that. I mean, that's pretty substantially off. You think it's going to make $70 million and it makes $105 million?
Well, let me tell you something. A day before it opens, when they're that off, then they're just lowering expectations because they know at that point.
No, I think it's just word of mouth. I mean, you know, I mean, it's on Wednesday. They don't know. The Thursday night was going to be huge. People were going to love it. The reviews were great. I think it's just word of mouth. Yeah, I think you can't predict people saying I loved it and telling their friends to go see it.
You know what you can do, though, however, what? since more than 50% of the North American movie screens are owned by three companies, you can call them your partners in exhibition, the cinema operators, and ask them, hey, what are the advanced sales for the Jungle Book?
Well, they include that in their tracking and when they predict, don't they?
They do, which is why they're basically lowering expectations to then make it pop even more.
Yeah, but that's 50% off. That's way off.
Yeah, that's absurd. Yeah.
So it was a big hit worldwide. India, of course, is the setting for the stories by Rudyard Kipling, once denounced as a colonialist, once world famous and beloved, then denounced as a white colonialist, now sort of praised again. I think he's a terrific writer and mostly not racist. it did a big opening there, $20 million. Already after 10 days, it is the third highest grossing U.S. film in India's history.
I would be interested to know how many of those screens showed the DCI DCP, So basically a DCP, a digital cinema, as opposed to what is known as e-cinema. So lower resolution, no encryption. And so the content is far less secure, but the cost of the equipment to play back e-cinema is much lower. And for Furious 7 last year, Universal actually released it on quite a number of screens in India through e-cinema because they could get a broader reach that way.
Well, I'm sure they must have done that. I would be interested in that. But also, of course, it just reminds you how much room India has to grow as far as development. And people are, developing the country, developing the screens, getting them up to higher quality, and then making a lot more money because there's 1 billion people there. Clearly, that market hasn't even begun to grow.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the big news last year was, the studios forced DCI, the Digital Cinema Initiatives, and all of the security and the high quality and the expensive equipment down everybody's throats when it was, in their best interest. But throughout the world, they struggled to pay for it all. That said, in India, when they can make money in India, we'll throw all that stuff out the window.
And of course, I want to know about 3D. This movie was available in 3D. I believe the premiere was in 2D, so that clearly is not the preferred way to see the movie. Don't spend your money on 3D when they don't premiere it in 3D. But okay, it's in 3D. They've really lowered the bar again. They don't tell us what it made opening weekend in 3D. They tell us how many screens were in 3D. So apparently, it was in 4,200 theaters. More than 3,000 of them offered the film in a variety of premium formats, and of those 3,000, about 43% included 3D.
Well, right here, I've got something from Real D. It says, The Jungle Book unleashes a mighty 3D roar at the box office with approximately 43% of the estimated $103.6 million domestic gross during its opening weekend.
Of the premium format screens, 43% offered 3D. And now you're telling me, guess what? The opening weekend box office was out absolutely at the same number, 43%. So they neither overperformed or underperformed. They matched exactly 43%. That's kind of weird.
But now internationally, okay, well, so worldwide, overseas, yeah. Not North America, 63%, including Brazil, 73%. And
we
get
know,
this.
We know overseas box office people.
China?
3Ds.
Right. China, 98% 3D.
Right. Well, but yeah, how many screenings were available in 2D?
I have no idea.
Maybe none. Maybe they didn't have a chance. If they wanted to see the movie, they had to see it in 3D. In China, it opened to $50 million. A big opening weekend. It's a franchise. They're going to make a sequel. I don't know how many sequels you can make out of The Jungle Book, but I guess if it's just an action film, you can.
Wait, so, it's one book, okay? One book, not books.
Well, it was two combined into one. It's a series of stories. I don't know how much the movie tracks. I assume the movie doesn't end with the boy leaving the jungle forever and going in to join the civilization, but maybe it does.
No, everybody knows he meets Jane and then starts swinging from vines.
$240 million worldwide, $290 million in counting, but it was expensive. It cost $175 million to make. Compare that to Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. That costs more to make, $250 million, and it's now at $830 million worldwide. So it's made its money back. It's a success. Didn't get great reviews like The Jungle Book. The Jungle Book should have great legs, but, you know, it tripled its budget. But these are big rolls of the dice. You know, we're going to see more and more movies of this big size tank, obviously, because you can't keep making $200 million movies and expect them all to work.
Yeah, I mean, at CinemaCon, the big news about Batman versus Superman, there were two pieces of news here. One was that it underperformed, well, didn't underperform. They expected it to perform better, and they were, you know, it was a bad movie.
They were hoping to make $1 billion.
Yeah, it was a bad movie, and they think it actually damaged the franchise. We'll see if that's true. The other thing is that, you know, all of these studios kind of come out and they give their presentation of movies that are coming up, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but they said we're trying to balance, you know, originality and familiarity, you know, so make original movies and make some that are familiar. Meanwhile, you have a year where you have Batman versus Superman, and then you have Captain America Civil War, where guess what? Superheroes duke it out with one another. So, you know,
there's 10, 15 movies in the DC universe lined up, 10 movies in the Marvel universe lined up, a Star Wars movie every year, an Avatar movie every year, eventually when they start to come out. So no, yes, of course. Hollywood always loves sequels and franchises. They have since the beginning of time. And number three around the world is Barbershop, The Next Cut. Speaking of sequels, the fourth film in the franchise, it grossed $20 million and it cost about $20 million to make. Success all around. And number four, a real success story from Disney, an original film, the animated movie Zootopia. Great reviews. We don't know what the movie cost, but we assume it's about $150, $175 million. It's now at $880 million worldwide. It could maybe get its way to $1 billion. This is really a big success story. And now, why do I say that? Because it's made about the same as Batman versus Superman.
But it costs,
you know,
less.
It's made about the same as, no, not really, not that much less. It's probably $175 million. It's not like it was $30 million and made a tons of money. But when it's a critical hit and a commercial hit and everybody loves it, somehow that $800 million seems a lot more valuable than $800 million from Batman versus Superman, where everybody goes, meh.
Yeah, well, because all of a sudden, Zootopia's in theme parks and the merchandise and the, you know, it's what they call IP, intellectual property, where they are spinning things off to video games and television shows and movies and toys, and that's Zootopia.
The Onion had a great headline. It said, producers of Batman versus Superman, basically, this is what they're saying. Producers of Batman versus Superman, just go see it and get it over with. That was their message to fans. And number five is Huntsman, Winter's War. This is a spinoff of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, a sequel to Snow White and the Huntsman. It cost $17 million to make. It's at $43 million worldwide. It's opened up overseas in some territories, and pretty much everywhere it's at, it's not doing great. And number six is The Boss, another Melissa McCarthy film. She seems to alternate between good movies and bad movies. This one is one of the bad ones, but it's making $44 million, and we'll have to see where it ends up. It's certainly not an expensive movie to make, but, you know, it would be nice if she made better movies. Hopefully the Ghostbusters will be good, and she will be making a cameo on The Gilmore Girls. I'm very excited for that show when it comes back. I don't know why. Maybe I shouldn't be, but, you know, at least she's popping in to say hi. And number seven is London Has Fallen, another $9 million over the weekend, $181 million worldwide. Hey, it tripled its budget. And number eight is Criminal, another flop for Lionsgate. Not a huge flop necessarily so far, but it stars Kevin Costner, made $7 million over the weekend, and it cost $32 million to make, and it got poisonously bad reviews. And number nine, here's really a shocker to me, Kung Fu Panda 3. Another $7 million. It's about to pass the $500 million mark. Again, it's a success story. It's going to make money, you know, $145 million to make. It tripled its budget. It's part of a franchise. It keeps the Kung Fu Panda name there. It did well in China. Toys and games will continue to be made. And yet, it's just, I thought it would have made a lot more money given the franchise, the quality of the movie, the reviews, the great 3D. People loved the 3D in this movie. And yet, this can't help but feeling like a disappointment.
Yeah, I guess you would expect it to make $600 million.
At least. And that's what the, you know, I mean, the first two did great. And this had great reviews. So why it should do so much poorly and Zootopia would do so great, I'm not sure I know why. I guess they waited too long to make it, I guess.
Probably.
At number 10 is 10 Cloverfield Lane. That's appropriate. That's the sort of, what was that movie called? Cloverfield.
Yeah, I was going to say, what movie are you referring to? There's so many of them.
It made $5 million over the weekend. It passed the $100 million mark. So this is a huge success story for a very low-budget movie. Clever, good reviews, fun. It's sort of the cult B movie that you'll love to catch on cable and DVD. And number 11 is My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2. They waited so long, people were actually happy to see it come back. $4 million over the weekend. $80 million worldwide. Of course, it's not going to make as much money as the original. Of course not, but they're going to make money. And everybody's happy. Looking down below, one more movie to mention is Les Visiteurs, The Visitors, La Révolution. It's a French fantasy comedy. It's the third in a series. It's been a while since they put one out. It's about medieval warriors who time travel to the present. It's made $54 million and counting, most of it in France. It's Jean Reno. It's a silly broad comedy. They did an English language remake. It didn't work. They played the movie here. It didn't really do that great, but it's a big hit film in Europe.
And number 14 is a film worth mentioning, Eye in the Sky. It's by a, you know, it was distributed by a small distributor and it's getting great reviews.
It's getting good reviews.
Yeah. And the, well, I think look on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's up there.
But you got to remember, Rotten Tomatoes is not, when it says 90% positive, that doesn't mean 90% raves. It means 90% of the people said it was okay or good or great. If you say the movie's, it's all right. Or you say the movie's a classic, a masterpiece. Those both count as a thumbs up under the Rotten Tomatoes way it works. So if everybody thought a movie was pretty good, it's pretty good. It's worth seeing. That gets 99%. If everybody thought it was a masterpiece, it gets 99%. So, you know, there's not a lot of nuance there. So it's not like Eye in the Sky got rave reviews. It was at festivals. It got nice reviews. It's well thought of. But it's not like going to be in the Oscar hunt or a masterpiece for all ages. But it does have, you know, a nice Rotten Tomatoes thing of, you know, 94%, which sounds amazing. But when you actually look at it, you know, the reviews are good, but they're not like raves.
Well, it was distributed by Bleecker Street Media, which is this small up-and-coming independent distributor. And that's really, so it's kind of a huge success story for them. And that's kind of what we're seeing. I don't want to say the wave of the future, but there's six big giant studios, okay? And more, because the cost of production is coming down and because not everybody really wants to see superheroes every weekend, some of these independent studios are actually getting quite a lot of notice. Spotlight, for instance, was released by Open Road, an independent distributor.
It was theater owners.
Well, owned by theater owners, correct.
Yeah. Owned by multinational conglomerates. Yeah, and the Sky's made $18 million. Good for them. It played a festival. It got attention. It got picked up. It's in theaters. It's a sort of small movie for adults that have always existed. Studios will never make, you know, don't want to make them, even though there's money to be made, but they're not interested. Heck, even the Met is doing well at the box office. The Metropolitan Opera, they tied for number 10 in North America with a screening of Donizetti's Roberto Devereux. It made $1.4 million over the weekend. So a good weekend for them. And consolidation is the name of the game, isn't it? You talked about those big conglomerates putting out movies. Consolidation in the North American market happened. It's happening all over the world, even in Korea, right?
Well, I don't necessarily know what you're referring to, but at least on the exhibition side, the cinema operator side, there's some, it's more growth through acquisitions and yes, thus consolidation. So you have CJCGV. This is a big South Korean company. They bought Mars Cinema, which is in Turkey, for $800 million. If that's what you're referring to, then yes.
It's the largest chain in Turkey, 83 locations, 736 screens. CJCGV is the largest one in Korea. They've expanded to China, Hong Kong, U.S., Turkey, Indonesia. They've got 2,000 screens worldwide now, and now it goes up to 2,700.
Yeah, and they have not been shy about saying, we are on the prowl. We're looking to expand through acquisitions. We're looking to build new theaters. We will be the biggest exhibitor in the world. Just watch. That's
all right.
That's their MO.
Maybe they should have a podcast.
They should, as a matter of fact. Guys, get in touch.
All right, so Sperling was at CinemaCon. The global box office, as they touted everyone, was $38.3 billion last year. It's a lot of money. That's why CGV is on the prowl for more exhibitors to purchase. And my favorite moment of all of CinemaCon was a little slide that Sperling texted to me.
And this was the slide. It was literally the opening keynote address Monday morning, even before International Day. We had both Tom Moulter, the head of distribution, international distribution, worldwide distribution at Warner Brothers. He's one of the heads there. He and Alejandro Ramirez Magana from Cinepolis, a big theater chain in India and Latin America. They both talked about 3D, which is already fading in some key international territories.
We know it's come back down to earth in North America, but it's been huge overseas, and we're starting to see that the curve where people get really excited and then levels back down. Now, all the studios basically think and believe and hope that 3D will remain about 30% of total box office or box office for the big tentpole movies. That's what they're hoping for, right?
Yeah, roughly. They say, look, you know, not everybody flies first class. Not everybody's going to want to see things in 3D. You're going to bring a family of five. You know what? Maybe 3D is not for you because you've got to buy five tickets.
And most movies shouldn't be made in 3D.
Right. So there's that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So of the movies that are in that are available, like Captain America, The Civil Wars, they're thinking ultimately maybe the total box office, they can expect 30% to be in 3D. That's where they think it will level out. I think it'll be even lower. I think it's just a few movies a year where you're actually going to want to pay extra to see it in 3D. But that's just me. But do it well, and I'm with you. I'm happy to see it. But it is, you know, we're already seeing what you and I have predicted for years that, okay, international, they're a little behind the U.S. The U.S., there was 80, 90% of opening weekend would be in 3D. That was happening for movies. Now it's way down to 40% opening weekend. What the total box office is in 3D, we often don't know because studios don't want to say because it's not that exciting. The numbers aren't that great. But there are always a few big movies like Jurassic World that make a lot of money in 3D. And now the rest of the world is finally, I think, going to get tired of paying big bucks for 3D, and it'll level back down just like that.
Well, that's until, you know, the guy who does 3D incredibly well comes along and gives us another movie. Of course, that is James Cameron. You know what? He's not going to give us just one more movie relating to Avatar. He's going to give us four Avatar sequels because one just isn't good enough.
One, he's been talking about two and then three for ages. And I was like, well, I'm going to make four. We're like, just make one. How about making one?
Yeah.
So now push back the schedule again. Christmas 2018. They expect Avatar 2, then 3, then 4, then 5, every Christmas after that, which means every Christmas potentially in 2018 and beyond, for 4 years, you would have a Star Wars movie and an Avatar movie. Both of them making $1 billion worldwide, at least, we're anticipating. They'll both made $2 billion with their last version. So at least billion-dollar movies in 2018, 2019, 2020, and 2021. So two movies, $2 billion right there. Total box office in North America is like $11 billion. And you're expecting both those movies to make at least $2 billion, if not $3 or $4 billion, right? I mean, the new Star Wars made, well, that was worldwide, but, you know, $900 million in North America, right?
Yes.
So, you know, that's, do you want to have your movie open at Christmas time if you're not Avatar or Star Wars?
Probably not. No.
but really?
Well, I mean, you do if you want to cross program and you have like an Oscar contender and you can open it Christmas Day limited and then platform it in January. That could work.
Yeah. So we've got all sorts of things going on. But the big news at the CinemaCon was Screening Room, right?
Well, they
weren't even officially part of the show, but everybody talked about it.
Yeah. And it was, as John Fithian, the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, said during when he met with reporters, he said, look, the Screening Room is a distraction.
Yeah, of course. You say it like it's truth. It's like, well, of course he wants it to be. Just shut up. Don't talk about Screening Room. We hate Screening Room. They're NATO. I mean, I agree with him. I don't like Screening Room either. It's a dumb idea, but of course he would say that.
Well, I guess what he's trying to say is, look, we have other
about Screening Room.
Yeah, we have other things to talk about here. You know, there's a world record box office. We have some interesting films and interesting technology coming down the pike. And instead, we're all talking about this thing that's in the home, which has nothing to do with this because, you know what?
We hate it. And yeah, we hate it.
and the studios aren't going to go for it because the math doesn't pencil for them. Okay, so it's like... The only reason we're talking about this is because it's some guy from Silicon Valley who's done it before, he's disrupted an industry before, and he's got the money to stick around a little bit longer.
And top directors like Peter Jackson go to CinemaCon and say, it's inevitable. He said, having big movies open day and date in the home, according to Peter Jackson, it's inevitable.
Well, of course, I don't know that he was at CinemaCon, but okay.
Well, he said it. Yeah, no, it was part of the news coverage of talking Peter Jackson, Sean Parker, CinemaCon, and Screening Room. So it was part of their coverage, even if he wasn't in attendance, that's what he said. And of course, and he doesn't clarify if he's been given a piece of the company or invested in the company. But in either case, he does have some stake in the company. He says right now, I've mostly invested time.
Yeah, that's what it's time. I've been on a few conference calls.
Right. And his big argument is, hey, look, come on. Half the people in North America didn't go to a movie last year. And of all the people that went, almost all of them, 95% of them, only saw one or two movies.
Okay, that's... Okay,
that,
whatever. Yeah,
doesn't sound right to me. Yeah. It sounds a little off. But nonetheless, they're saying, look at all these people who aren't going to movies. We got to reach them, right? That's the big argument, right? It sort of makes some sense, doesn't it? You go, well, gee, that's a lot of people who don't go to movies. Oh, we got to reach them. We got to do Screening Room. But of course, that implies that you're not already reaching them. Just because they didn't go to the movies doesn't mean they're not watching movies in their home. Who do you think is watching movies on demand? Who do you think is watching DVDs and Blu-ray? Who do you think subscribes to Netflix? Who do you think pays for pay-per-view? Those are people being reached. Yeah. You know, it's just the question is, would you make even more money if you didn't make them wait 12 weeks? So, I mean, look at Deadpool. One of the biggest out-of-left-field hits, I guess, as far as you could say. I mean, it's a Marvel movie, but nonetheless... Low budget, opened in February, monster hit, came out in February 12th. It's hitting Blu-ray and DVD on May 10th, less than 12 weeks later.
And I can guarantee you that early electronic sell-through, so if you want to buy it on iTunes.
A week or two earlier, right. It should be any day now. It'll be available. It'll be available May 1st, probably, on sell-through.
Correct.
If not sooner. If not 2 weeks in advance. So if not May 1st, you know, it could be April 25th. So it should be like next week. But I haven't seen any notice of that, so I'm holding off. Normally, I would know that by now, but it's sort of a quick movie. But yeah, exactly. So the question is not all these people who don't go to movies, are they watching movies in their homes? Of course they are. That's where all those tens of billions of dollars is being generated. You know, there's a lot of money being made. The question is, if you collapse that window even further, is that a good idea? So the idea that 50% of people don't go to the movies, therefore we got to do something, well, we already are. We're making them available on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming and on demand and all this sort of thing. And they're saying, yeah, but you'd make even more money if you made it available right away.
Well, by the they, we're talking about the folks behind the Screening Room.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Whereas, you know, look, you had Kevin Sugihara, who's the head of Warner Brothers, say, I assure you, we are not going to let a third party or middleman come between us, because that's really what's going on.
No, we don't care if it's a third party. We don't care if the studios could do it on their own. The question is it a good idea? Is collapsing the window even further a good idea? Forget Screening Room. Is it a good idea? Probably not. It's already so available pretty quick.
A lot of the people who took the stage, okay, except for J.J. Abrams. A lot of the people at CinemaCon were saying, yeah, no, it's not a good idea.
Right.
Todd Phillips made his whole, he's the director of the upcoming War Dogs.
He said, boo, boo.
He's like, he said, look, I'm just flying in for the day. I just got here. I wrote this stuff on the plane. They put it on the teleprompter for me. But I've got a question. I'm a little confused because I'm trying to figure out what is going on with this, like trying to get movies into the home the same time there are movie theaters. Why are we trying to destroy the movie theater experience and that market? Why are we trying to basically cannibalize that?
Right. So all the studios hate it. All the theater owners hate it, except for AMC, who was forced by their Asian overlords to say that they would consider it with all sorts of caveats involved. But they're not really enthusiastic about it. They make clear, hey, we're not excited by it. So basically, almost no theaters like it. None of the studios like it. It's not going to happen.
No, well, and look at Amazon. Amazon Studios bought their way into the business. They went to Sundance. They picked up like 8-9 films. They were at CinemaCon this year, along with Lionsgate. So you had all of the STX Entertainment. You had at least two new studios showing up. And both were saying, especially Amazon. Amazon saying, you know what? We're making movies.
Well, there's lots of reasons for that, not just Screening Room.
Yes. But yes, that's true. That is true. Screening Room has little to nothing to do with why these new studios are showing up. That's a whole other bailiwick. But what Amazon is saying very clearly is, we all know who Netflix is. We all know how they distribute movies. That is not the way we distribute movies. We distribute movies through giving them a premium platform in movie theaters and cinemas first, letting them play out, and then we can put them on DVDs or put them on streaming platforms. That's the way we release movies, which is exactly what the industry, or at least certain players in the industry, want to hear.
Exactly. Here's the best thing that I liked about this, the sort of most practical take on this, beyond the fact that, hey, the studios and the theaters don't like it, so it's not happening. The only people who like it are the people who invest in it. And the nerve of Peter Jackson, who else was the other one? There was someone else who refused to, oh, J.J. Abrams. He declined to say whether he was a shareholder. Are you f-ing kidding me? Do you have a piece of the company? Did they give it to you, or did you invest in it? Like, I don't need to see your financial records, but you're going to stand on stage and tell me you're touting this business and you won't tell me whether you own a piece of it? That's ridiculous. He should be laughed off the stage for that. And I'll laugh at him personally if he calls me. But what I loved was this survey that they did. It was reported in Variety. I wish I saw who did it. I'm sorry, I'm looking. I don't see it. But it was a study. They're like, all right, Screen Room. Would people actually want this? So they said, hey, Do you want a new set-top box in your home? It costs $150.
No.
They're like, no, I don't want a new set. Good God, I want fewer set-top boxes. By the way, it's going to have a remote with it. Do you want another remote in your home?
No.
They said, all right. So think about it. The first movie, you have to pay $200. You got to pay $150 for the set-top box and then $50 for the movie. That's just to watch one movie. Of course, you know, amortizes over time. But what if we gave you the set-top box for free? Would you want another set-top box in your home?
No.
No, it's like people don't want another damn device in their home. It's really a non-starter, isn't it?
Well, and that study was done by MarketCast, kind of a well-known industry research firm.
And I say again, the idea that you look at all these people who aren't going to the movies, we got to reach them. Well, you are. That's why DVD and Blu-ray at one point was like bigger than the box office, because you're making tens of billions of dollars on pay-per-view and on demand and rental and streaming and all that stuff. You are reaching them. How many people don't see a movie at all in a year? And of those people, would you reach them if a movie was available day and date in their home? I doubt it, right? Whoever that crazy person is who only reads books and doesn't have TV, you know, God bless them, but they're probably not going to be excited if you make it available day and date.
Yeah, I would agree. I think you still have to... There are reasons both hardcovers and paperbacks exist, and there is a reason for the cinema to exist, and there's a reason for home entertainment to exist. They don't necessarily need to exist together at the same time. You know what, though? You're talking about this MarketCast study. It's all data, right? And mm-hmm. Data is really... That is the next big thing for this industry. You see movie theater owners turning to data more and more. Before, they'd have 10,000 people show up at their theater over the weekend. Those 10,000 people would leave. They had no idea who they were. And yeah, they might know a little bit because of some loyalty programs and you get extra points or a free bucket of popcorn. Now, they're parsing and slicing and dicing all this data because they are trying to market directly to their customers. They want to know who they are, when they come. They want to know everything about them. This used to be the purview of big studios, and the cinema owners were just happy to have the big studios take it over because it was expensive. Now, because there's consolidation and these companies are getting bigger, the theater owners and the theater chains are getting bigger, the theater chains are taking it on as much as the studios are.
Well, that's the one thing you miss at the festival, at the CinemaCon, that I'm sorry about, is the Ang Lee demo.
Well, that wasn't at CinemaCon. That was at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention, NAB.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Is it like an adjunct, or is it to take place the day after?
It's a completely separate event. It just happened to coincide this year with CinemaCon.
And that's where you get to geek out on new technology, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's mostly broadcasters for a lot of television, but they have 2 days up front of, you know, cinema technology.
And that's where Ang Lee showed?
He showed some very high frame rate, 120 frames per second. And film is shot at 24 frames per second, traditionally. And this is HFR even beyond twice as fast as what, more than twice as fast as what Peter Jackson did for The Hobbit. So this is 120 frames per second in 4K 3D. And
it was done with two projectors.
Yes, well, because you kind of have to, yeah, at that
right,
frame
so
rate.
This is not something that people are going to see when this movie hits theaters in the fall.
Well, in some theaters, they probably will. Let's, you know, there are some
really?
Theaters.
Two, yes. Screen, two projectors in one
Oh yeah, they absolutely have. There are some cinemas that actually have two projectors. In some cases, because the screen is so big that they can't light the screen with just one projector. For others, it's just a 3D thing. You know, it depends on the theater. But in this case, what they're doing is they're showing one projector will show the right eye, I believe, and one projector will show the left eye, and that way they can do 120 frames per second in each eye. And they can process all that. The servers can and the projectors can process all of that information that quickly.
Huh. And it apparently was just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I was at Coachella sweating in the desert. And all of a sudden, midday, my phone blows up with all of these tweets and texts. My goodness, you have to see this. It's unbelievable. And these are people who don't like 3D. People like James Gardner, one of our listeners, who said it's impressive. It's actually something that looks really decent. It's unlike what happened when Peter Jackson showed HFR, high frame rate, for The Hobbit for the first time, and everybody ran screaming from the movie theater going, I can't believe he's ruining this movie. And this was quite the opposite, the exact opposite reaction, which is you really have to try and see this if you can.
That sounds cool. I look forward to checking it out. And you'll be checking out Cannes, won't you? You'll be at the Cannes Film Festival this year?
I hope to be.
Yeah, well, either you are or you're not. You got your room, you got your badge.
I don't know about the badge because, you know, that's always a questionable.
A last minute, yeah.
Yeah. But the room, we can thank our good friend Stephen Garrett for that.
All right, so you're set. I'm sadly not going, but they announced the lineup. Very impressive. If you've got new movies by the Dardens and Jeff Nichols and Xavier Dolan, I'm very excited. I'm sorry I won't be there. But the cool, interesting thing was that Amazon has four films at Cannes.
Yeah, no, they are going at this. Seriously, they're taking this business very, very seriously. They've got the right people in place for the most part, and they're working with all comers. And they've got Cafe Society, The Neon Demon, and
that's the Nicholas Winding Refn film.
Yeah, and he was at CinemaCon via Skype, and Elle Fanning was there. You know, they kind of talked via Skype in front of everybody during a lunch as a way to promote that film. Patterson and The Handmaiden are the four films
The last two are the Jim Jarmusch film, and The Handmaiden is a new Korean film by Park Chan-wook.
Right. And, I mean, these are not, well, they're going to be there to be sold. No, they're in Cannes. They are in competition in some form or another.
Cafe is the opening night film, but the others are in competition.
Correct.
And they really had sort of been wary of allowing a filming competition that was available from one of these new sources. No matter who the director was, they were sort of worried about it. They didn't want to start having movies play at Cannes and then go right to streaming. They cared about it just the same way that theater owners care about it. They didn't want to be associated with something that was just going to be showing up on your computer screen. And so now that logjam has broken. You know, they said, all right, Amazon's made clear these are all going to be seen in movie theaters. That's where they're going to debut. So Cannes is willing to take them on.
Yeah, that's actually some big news, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, they're basically saying we're not a television festival. We're a film festival. And if you're going to show your film on a big screen like we do here at the film festival, they will think about it. Now, I know that Thierry Frémaux got some pushback about, hey, gee, let's see. You have basically everybody that's been in the festival before. You don't have any new faces.
But, you know, that's what happens. Like, you can't get in there, and there's some territories missing. But it's like you can't book a festival geographically, you know. The last year they had tons of films from Italy, and this year they have, like, none, I think, or something like that. It's like, well, next year there will be films from it. You know, it's like you can't control when movies are available and ready and, you know, here to be made.
No, but I definitely understand the kind of consternation over, gee, look, you invited Xavier Dolan again.
What do you mean? Xavier Dolan is a classic example of what they should do. He started off in Directors in Certain Regard or Directors Fortnight, and then In Certain Regard, and then the critics. I mean, he's worked his way up the chain into competition.
No, absolutely. I guess,
yeah,
what's
the point? He's one of the best directors alive today. Why wouldn't you support him? Why wouldn't you want
to? I'm not.
You are criticizing.
I said I can understand.
Yes, but that's the
lame
way of saying I agree with it.
But what I would say is this year, yes, all of these folks have been in the festival. Would it have been nice to see one new face? Yeah, maybe. You know what? Go to Un Certain Regard. Maybe that's where they're going to start, and that's where you'll see them kind of graduate into the festival at large and the competition films. But these are amazing directors, and maybe some of the next year's amazing directors are in Directors Fortnight or Un Certain Regard, and as I just mentioned, they'll work their way around.
Right. I mean, and, you know, obviously you always want more women. There's Andrea Arnold's in there with a Shia LaBeouf film. That'll be a talked about film.
Oh, I'm
sure. You've got the hot Romanian directors. You've got Xavier Dolan, who's such a rising talent. But you definitely have some old familiar faces who probably aren't delivering world-class movies. There probably could have been something better, like Almodovar and Sean Penn and Jim Jarmusch and Bruno Dumont with a comedy. You know, so yeah, there's probably stuff there that you could say, gee, I wish that had been in a certain regard or Directors for a Night. And you'll look at some movies in those other areas and go, why did they not have that? But that's what happens every year.
Yeah. And I don't know whether I think that Christy, I can't pronounce his last name, the Romanian director. I think he's been in a certain regard, but I don't know if he's been in the festival at large. But you see, there's a classic.
In the main competition film, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a classic example of a filmmaker working, you know.
I believe he has, because I thought 4 months was in competition, but maybe I'm wrong.
That is actually Christian Manjou.
Oh, you're talking about Christy Pui.
Oh, thank you. I couldn't.
I don't know how to say it. I'm not saying it right.
Yeah.
But the director of Sierra Nevada.
Correct.
I don't think he has been in competition yet, but maybe I'm wrong too.
But so, you know, look. Paul Verhoeven, kind of an interesting choice there. So.
But again, that's an old familiar where you go, well, maybe he's done a great movie, you know. So we don't know until you see the films. Every year you see films, and you think, why is this in competition? And you see a movie that's out and you think, how could that not be in competition? But that's what happens. You got thousands of movies to look at and you're trying to juggle all these competing, you know, needs. you know, you got to have some movies with stars in them. You got to have represent different territories. You don't want to let down old friends. You want to keep touting the talent that you love, like the Dardennes and Xavier Dolan. You know, it's complicated. It ain't easy.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't easy trying to see all the bands at Coachella over this weekend either.
Well done. It was a nice transition.
Oh, I was like, well done. How do you know who I saw? I missed 90% of the bands.
Right. You were at Coachella. You had fun. Guns N' Roses, you weren't a big fan of.
No, not a big fan of Guns N' Roses. You know what? Look, the funny thing is that night I was back at the hotel, pulled up Twitter, you know, because I'm old.
Oh, You didn't go.
Well, what are you talking about?
You didn't see Guns N' Roses' show?
Well, I saw portions of it.
Oh, you are old.
I am old, yeah. But there I am. I pulled up Twitter because, again, I'm old, and Twitter is for older people, not for the teeny boppers or the 20-year-olds, apparently. And there's two things that are trending, both of which I think, well, this is because of Coachella. Axl Rose is trending on Twitter worldwide. And I'm like, huh, I wonder why. So I click on it. And is it because he's performing live at Coachella with Guns N' Roses for the first time in umpteen years? No, it's because he was just hired as the lead singer of AC/DC.
Not quite. He's stepping in. Yeah.
Yeah. For
the lead
Brian
singer
Johnson.
Of AC/DC has. Yeah. The same day he was doing Coachella, he said he would tour with them. They have dates in Europe, but their lead singer has to step down or he'll lose his hearing permanently. They had to cancel some U.S. dates. The European tour was in turmoil. And so Axl Rose is showing up. He's going to sing with AC/DC in Europe and then finish up those 10 days in North America. It will not interfere with the Guns N' Roses thing. It's not a permanent thing as far as we know. It's just to help them out. So what a crazy mashup that is.
Yeah, I mean, who would have thought?
Sort of something you'd see at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and instead, you know, for one night only, and instead he's going to tour with them. I mean, after not touring at all for years and being fat and tired, and now Guns N' Roses is back, and he's like, and I'll tour with AC/DC. Well, all right.
And who would have thought in 2016 that Axl Rose would have not just one job, but two?
Exactly. So there's a list in our show notes of all the acts, a lot of the acts you saw, and some impressions of them, like you love Sufjan Stevens and Sia, right?
Yes. Okay. So Sufjan Stevens, I know, Michael, you like him, correct?
I'm crazy about him. He's great. His new album is a masterpiece.
Right. And it's kind of folky, kind of like indie.
Oh, it's sad, quiet, dark night of the soul. It's like Pink Moon by Nick Drake. It's very sad and quiet.
Yeah. And there I thought, wow, they put him on the outdoor theater at night, first night. I thought, God, that's going to be weird and depressing. And oh my God, it was so bizarre and off the hook bizarre. I mean, he was running around with angel wings to open the show. Then he had this big disco ball outfit. He did costume changes on stage. He had a balloon suit and he was running around. It was incredible. I mean, it was lively. It was entertaining. It was worth seeing and not nearly as depressing. Not depressing at all. It wasn't as grim as you would think based on the album.
Yeah. It sounded like, you know, as always, some acts were great, some acts were disappointments. That's what's going to happen. Guns N' Roses showed up on time. Well-run festival, basically. I think the big news out of here was people feeling like it's just gotten so expensive. It just feels like a one percenter event now.
Well, let's put it this way. Grimes was, you know, I said that there were two people trending on Twitter that night. Grimes was the other one. Why? Because Taylor Swift and Lorde were dancing around. And I saw that actually up at the front of the stage there. They were kind of in the little exclusive area where like artists get to like party.
Well,
with themselves.
Well, I mean, that doesn't seem weird that the artists would have a safe area.
Yeah, no, I mean, that doesn't actually.
But the experience of the festival overall, is it become so expensive and so high-priced food, all these exclusive areas where you can't get in? Does it feel more like you're pressed up against the fence, or does it still feel like a fun, spirited, we're all here for the music thing?
I think for the older crowd, people 35 and over, it's the, hey, we're here for the music, okay? Which is why the older crowds weren't necessarily enamored of Guns N' Roses, because they remember when Axl Rose, A, could walk, okay, because he broke his leg and was sitting in a chair.
Well, it's not his fault, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And B, actually had a voice, and so it reminded everybody over the age of 35 how old they were, whereas under the age of 35... everybody thought it was, you know, a pretty decent show, but they're not comparing it to what it used to be.
No, I mean the experience of the festival overall, not Guns N' Roses.
Right. So that's what I'm getting at is that for people in their 40s, it's all about the music. And for people like between the ages of like say 18 and 32, it's really more of a social experience. You're sitting there trying to watch the music, and they're having a conversation behind you as loud as they can possibly have one, and they're sitting there.
This is not quite what I'm getting at. I mean, that sounds more like a different of like what you do at a festival. Are you holding up your cell phone, or are you just listening and watching? I want to know money-wise and time-wise, and whether you personally, did you feel like you were always, you know, cut out of the cool area, or the people over, you're watching people over there watch the show? Was it more distancing, or was it unpleasant, or was it, did it feel like any other festival you've been to?
It's felt like at every other festival I've been to. Just this year, it keeps getting more and more expensive, and it is bordering on that, like, gee, do I really want to do this?
Uh-huh.
What I have noticed, though, is much like it's getting more and more expensive, for the acts, the attempt to try and outdo the next act or the act that came before you, it was a cavalcade of Coachella cameos. So disclosure comes, hey, Lorde comes on stage with him, Sam Smith, you had Zed, Kesha came out for Zed, like an electronica DJ, like an EDM act.
You're like, just do a set, for God's sakes. Blow us away with the music.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Sia, for instance, Sia is different. I mean, she, as you know, Michael, we talked about this. She doesn't like to show her face. She didn't even have a band, okay? She just played to backing track. She stood on a box with a microphone, never moved. I mean, she may have moved the box in between, but it was it was all like a Cirque du Soleil act. So she had...
Well, that sounds like a performance art piece if she's not moving. Cirque du Soleil is a lot of movement.
Well, correct. Who moved for her? She had, again, a cavalcade of cameos. Tig Notaro, the comedian, came out and did this weird mimey thing. The dancing girl from all of her videos, you know, she was there with...
Well, they're putting on a visual show, right? They got a big crowd.
Not only visual on stage, but because she was on the main stage, that's probably like, you can have 80,000 people standing there watching that main stage. It's big. It's huge.
Wow, I really would not enjoy that.
So she,
unless I'm in the first 30 rows, I don't want to be there.
Well, and you may
That's
not want to be in the
idea
first.
Of fun.
Well, she actually,
I'm sick of stadium acts. I don't want to say there's 80,000 people at the main stage. Are
well,
you serious?
There could be on certain acts.
I'm like, saying there's room for that.
Well, yeah, but it stretches out like two football fields.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you.
So that said, there were these two huge screens to the left and right of the stage. She actually used those as a screen with CGI live. So at one point, one of the dancers was breaking a window, and window after window was being broken with, you know, like they were karate chopping it. There was no window there. It was on stage, no window.
Yeah.
But on screen,
it's a show, a performance. I just want to know what the whole thing was like. Are you going to go next year?
You know, every year.
You don't feel like it's just too, like, you're like cut out, and there's the billionaire class is up there and over there, and you're way back behind them. That's not your experience.
No, what I will say, though, is that if you look at it, James Bay, okay, you know him, Mike Snow, these are two huge acts, and they get put in small
They're not huge.
Well, let's put it this way.
No, they're not huge.
Based on the number of people.
No, it's not huge.
Well, based on the number of people that showed up for his set opposite a headliner.
That's not, I mean, how do you define huge? If, it's like not huge.
Well, okay, let me ask you.
The Swedish pop band, a Swedish indie pop band, them? Is that what you mean?
Mike Snow?
They're cool. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you happen to know who...
You got three albums out.
Right. And do you know who Zella Day is?
No. I'm just saying they haven't, none of their albums have gone gold. I don't know. How do you define, they don't have hit singles.
Zella Day, they're a cool
small act.
Okay. Let's just go back to James Bay for a second.
Okay.
Couple hit songs, right? Performed on the Grammys, plays in a small tent, while at the same time on the much larger stage, Zella Day, who you've never heard of, who hasn't performed on the Grammys, who may not have as many hits or any, is playing on this big outdoor theater. Now, part of that is crowd control. They want to spread the crowds out. They want to put somebody over in the corner to get some of the crowd, a little further away from the main stage.
James Bay has one album, a couple of EPs, one top 40 hit single called Let It Go.
And Hold Back the River?
That didn't chart.
Okay.
I'm looking at it right now. It didn't chart. It was released as a single. It was a hit in Europe, but it did not chart in the U.S.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get
I'm just saying, there's, it's not like they put the Stones on a side stage, It's a cool act.
Speaking of the Stones. So Paul Tollett and Golden Voice, the group that puts on, Coachella. I was just there. I have Coachella brain right now. They want to put on a festival in the fall with, Hall of Famers. So you have Bob Dylan, Rolling Stones, any Hall of Famer, and over 3 days in the same location on the polo fields in Indio. I can't even imagine how much that's going to cost.
Won't cost me anything.
Well, I no, but when they put it on sale.
Because I won't go.
Right. Well, I mean, look.
Why would I want to go to a place and watch Dylan with 100,000 people? It's the worst way to see an act. I don't know why you'd want to go anymore. I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to see you two or Bruce Springsteen, 40,000 people in front of me of that far away from the stage. What is the point? I'd rather go to a club and see somebody close up. You can see James Bay in a small club. You can see him at the Beacon, for God's sakes. Tell me he's a big act. You can see James Bay or Mike Snow in a club in New York City. Why the hell would you want to see him with 30,000 people in front of you? I'd rather see them when I can actually see the act. And people aren't chatting and on their Snapchat next to me while I'm doing it.
Okay, that is one thing. I actually heard somebody today, listen to me, this weekend, say, it just didn't happen if I didn't Snapchat it. If I didn't Snapchat it, it didn't happen.
Yeah, I bought ice cream yesterday downtown, and the hipsters refused to eat their ice cream until they'd taken 14 photos of it. It's melting in their hands, and they're still trying to get the right angle. I'm like, eat your ice cream.
I don't get Snapchat. I'm trying to understand it, but it's a slow process. What I will say is that it's nice to see acts over a period of time mature. Matt and Kim first saw them in a tiny little tent, and then they hit the a bigger tent than the outdoor theater. This is who they are, Michael, right?
Yeah.
It's a drummer.
They're not a big act, but they're cool.
They're on the main stage at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the afternoon, cool. Evening. I thought, oh my God, how are they going to pull this off? And they did it to their own amazement. The sheer joy when they were done and they saw all of these people actually showed up and, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people jumping up and down. And they thought, how did we do this? This was supposed to be a big failure not necessarily a failure, but it was supposed to be difficult. And it wound up being fantastic for them.
A Coachella moment.
A Coachella moment, correct.
So it was a big deal for them.
I would say, I don't know if it was a big deal for them. They made it seem afterwards when they were looking at each other and like just over the moon as if relieved and it was a big deal for them. Oh, wait a second.
There you go.
I just realized what you were trying to do. You know what was a big deal, actually? Not to stay on the whole Coachella of it all. Mm-hmm. The cell phone coverage, it didn't crap
out.
Did
they add in a tower or two?
There were tons of towers. The coverage was good, except for Saturday night when there were just too many people there. Tons of phone, chargers. You could charge almost anywhere. It was pretty nice, actually. But they, look, Coachella has expanded. The grounds have expanded. Everything is bigger. It's two weekends now. This was weekend one. Weekend two is next week. I'm sure weekend two will be as much of a big deal as weekend one was. Oh, wait, you already transitioned us. Never mind. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Louis C.K.'s out-of-nowhere TV drama, Horace and Pete, is ending just as abruptly as it began. The show was done on the QT by the CK, get it? And nice. A host of actors like Steve Buscemi and Alan Alda, they just plopped it out there on the internet so the world could discover what they were doing and watch and experience the show without any preconceptions about what it was or how good it would be. Critical acclaim followed, and now after 10 episodes, guess what? It's over. CK says the self-funded show ended up costing him, roughly $4 million out of pocket. though, of course, monetization has just begun since people can now buy the 10 episodes for $31 and eventually on Blu-ray and the like. He's not done with it exactly. CK was so busy making it that only now is he ready to go out and beat the drum to get people to actually watch it. Emmy nominations are likely in his future as well. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
I think it's a big whoop overall. I don't think it's the future of TV because it's an expensive proposition. And you know what? You shouldn't put your own money into your own show. That's just a good rule of thumb. But it's very, very cool. And I can't wait to check it out.
Disney is recycling every animated classic they made into a live action movie. Cinderella? Check. Snow White? Done. The Jungle Book? Just opened. Pinocchio? In the works. They're also environmentally sound when it comes to backstage plot twists. Setting up a clear heir to the throne has bedeviled the house that Walt built ever since, well, Walt, actually. Michael Eisner was a particularly rocky one. They solved that problem with Bob Iger. His heir apparent was Thomas Staggs. Everyone knew it. Everyone was happy. Everyone was expecting it. Well, except the Disney board. They weren't happy, which they decided, the Disney board, it wasn't so confident that Staggs had the experience, and they refused to make it official. And now Staggs, who kind of sees that Iger is in no hurry to step down, a board that left him hanging and decided, if you wanted really to be, to see a happy ending, then he needed to go somewhere else. So Iger is still in charge, and there's no heir in sight. Again, Iger's contract ends in 2018. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? I mean, this is a big problem. It's a big company. Obviously, Iger is a huge, hard act to follow, but he'll probably be up for another year or two, right? He's fine. He's only in his 60s or something. So,
correct.
You know.
Well, and remember, this was supposed to be, Iger was going to go off and do this whole thing with the NFL and bring an NFL team to Los Angeles and help build a stadium. And that was going to be his thing. Then the St. Louis Rams moved back to Los Angeles and kind of nixed that whole thing. So he had nothing to do. So all of a sudden he's back at Disney, and that's when this thing happens. So, and what is a shame, you might recall when we covered Staggs being kind of dubbed heir apparent, I said, gee, it was really between Thomas Staggs and the CFO at the time. I hope that I think it was the CFO or the chief operator. I can't remember who it was, but they basically, I said, I hope they don't push him out or he doesn't choose to leave because he's a great executive. And
gone.
He's gone. He was gone like a year and a half ago or last year.
Now they're going to lose Staggs.
And now they lost Staggs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's what a mess. Anyway, speaking of a mess, does the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame realize that it's broken? I don't know. Everything about the still young institution is faltering. Artists being honored are complaining about the hall on stage during their big moment. They're complaining even more loudly to the press backstage. Women are being ignored. NWA gets honored. And when some people can't stop questioning whether they even belong in the hall, the band itself won't reunite and perform because they said the hall wouldn't work with them to make it happen. Steve Miller was caustic, explaining how when he was told he got in, he was offered, two tickets, one for himself and one for his wife. The rest of his band, their spouses, $10,000. That's right, $10,000 a ticket. Thank you very much. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, there's been a little pushback against Steve Miller. He's apparently kind of a jerk. The Black Keys inducted him, and they were super excited. They went on their own dime to do it. And he was like, yeah, who are you? Like, he couldn't be bothered to find out who was inducting him and who they were. If you didn't know who someone was that was coming to induct you, you might Google them. Or, if you're into music, you might, listen to the latest. I mean, it's not like they're obscure. But so he apparently was kind of a really a big jerk. But all the problems. NWA wouldn't perform, or wouldn't, or didn't get to perform because the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame dropped the ball.
You know what, though?
A lot of people are unhappy.
They had their chance. NWA had their chance this weekend. Ice Cube played on Saturday night. He had his chance. He brought out most of the, of course, some of NWA.
He's dead, of course.
Right.
Yeah, we know that.
But you'd think that Dr. Dre would have shown up for one song and then they could have had their little NWA reunion.
He's a busy mogul. Well, yes, but I'm saying,
however,
they wanted to do it at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and it didn't happen. And they're pointing the finger at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Steve Miller's complaining about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Everybody's angry at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It feels like it's a bit of a mess. You look at all the women who aren't in the hall that should be or could be, and it feels like it's a broken system.
Yeah, again, I'll go back to NWA. I don't know that that's true. I mean, when Ice Cube brought out Common,
What's he got to do with the hall?
Well,
that's because Dr. Dre didn't go to Coachella. You're saying that means it's not the hall's fault? They were all there. They wanted to do it, but they couldn't make it happen because the hall was being difficult. Steve Miller says, it's kind of dicky. It's the Steve Miller band. You're telling me you tour with and play with Steve Miller for 40 years. You create all these albums. He gets in the hall and like, oh, you want to show up? Oh, you got to pay $10,000. You know, it's kind of dicky.
Yeah. That is true. That I will agree with.
You get two tickets? You know, he's like, I'm not alone here. You know, it's the Steve Miller band. They toured with me for 40. I get two tickets? You know, that's way to honor me. You know, write a check. Hey, lucky you. You're in the hall. Write us a check for $100,000 and your band can come too.
Well, that's kind of what happens when you get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. They say, hey, you're getting a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. You have to pay for it. Although usually it's a studio because there's a film coming out and the studio pays for it because it's a big publicity thing anyway, but you do have to pay to maintain it. So that's kind of an odd thing. In any case, you know, speaking of tickets, some of the hardest tickets in New York, Michael, as you know,
today, somebody's texting me. All right. I want to go see Waitress and She Loves Me. Are you sure I can't get tickets to Hamilton?
You totally can. How much money do you have?
You can. How much do you want to pay?
He's yes.
Like, well, I'm like, no. Then if you want to pay $500 for a ticket, you can get a ticket.
Yes. And that's not going to be a good one.
How many times can I say this?
Yes. Well, a lot of Hamiltons will be made by the hit Broadway musical Hamilton, Michael, as we've discussed numerous times on this show. And now some 24 actors and dancers will share in the bounty. After lengthy negotiations, producers have arranged that the talent involved in the show's development and ultimate mounting will get a piece of the action thanks to being in the room where it happened. Get it, Michael?
Keep going.
Per the New York Times, the agreement is unlikely to make any of the performers rich, but the money could make a significant difference in their lives. The base salary for a Broadway performer is about $1,900 a week. Stars often make more, of course. And many actors have significant periods of unemployment between jobs. Payments to actors in other shows with profit sharing have varied from a few hundred dollars a year to a few thousand dollars a month. Hamilton is netting upwards of $500,000 a week in profits, and that will only grow as touring and overseas productions and the eventual movie and the book and the spinoff and the live action, you know, all that stuff's going to happen. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. First of all, the Times. Actually, if somebody gives me a couple thousand dollars a month, that'll make a big difference in my life. Thank you very much. Maybe you make six figures, but if I get an extra $36,000 a year, I'm going to be very happy.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving beyond that, there was a great story in the New York Times about a breakdown of who actually gets what in royalties and all this stuff. It's fascinating. Like Lin-Manuel gets like $100,000 a week. That doesn't even include what he makes for performing in the show. But check that out. It's very interesting. But this is a big issue. I mean, the actors and the choreographers and the people and the dancers, not the choreographers, but the dancers, they're there at the beginning. They work on the show for 2 years. Most shows, of course, don't make any money.
Most shows don't go on for 2 years either. So,
well, 2 years means you're one of the longest hits in history. Of course not. Yeah, of course not. But when they do break big, should they get money? It's been a problem since the Chorus Line and long before that. Basically, the idea is, hey, you know what? 1% of it set aside and all those 20 or 30 people get to take a share. You know, it seems like the decent thing to do for when that rare show does become a monster hit. They have no power. You know, if Stephen Sondheim wants to make a new show, does anybody else involved say anything other than thanks for letting me be involved? You know, as far as the actors, you know, are they making the show happen? Are they raising the money? No, but they're there. They're helping craft it and make it. And it's starting to become more regular. Like, hey, you've got to let them take, you know, when they're there at the beginning with something like Book of Mormon or Hamilton, you've got to let them share.
And then you start seeing people try to capture lightning in a bottle more than once, where the public canceling a recent workshop because they couldn't come to an agreement with the actors on profit sharing. And you kind of go, yes, we did it once before and it was called Hamilton. However, we've been around for like 40, 50, 60 years and it's happened like maybe a handful of times. So why does everybody think the next production is going to be Hamilton?
Well, they don't, but they think, hey, if something happens, we want to be there and participating. And I don't know who was the person that backed out of that, whether it was the producers of the show or the actors or the, I don't know that it was the public itself that made it not happen.
Oh, okay.
It fell apart because people could not come to agreement who the people were and what the stumbling block was. I don't know. But the general feeling is, hey, you never know. That's why you've got to have this in place. My God, I'm cursing today. You got to have these agreements in place at the beginning because you know, they're not going to make money if it doesn't work. You know, you're not going to lose anything. It's only when they work.
Did you know that the premium cable channel Starz has more subscribers than Showtime, Michael?
I did not.
Yeah, actually. We didn't, actually. HBO leads in North America with 32.5 million subscribers. Starz is second with 23.6 million, and Showtime is right behind with 23.4 million. And just like HBO and Showtime, Starz has launched a standalone app that includes its hit shows like Outlander, Da Vinci's Demons, and Black Sails. It costs $9 a month, so you're going to have to pay for it. Who needs cable when you can pay about $35 for those three channels alone? Wait a second. Yeah, actually, then I might need cable. But wait, there's more. Now Amazon is launching a standalone video service. Their video offerings used to be for Amazon Prime customers only. Okay, so you had to pay the $99 per year. Amazon thought, why limit themselves? So if you don't want to pay for Amazon Prime, but do want to watch Transparent and Mozart in the Jungle and the like, you can now. You'll pay $9 a month for Amazon Video. If you want monthly access to Amazon Prime in full, it's only $11 a month. So that's four channels for about $44. Toss in Hulu without ads for $12. You're up to $56. You know, I like ESPN. Oh, they don't have anything yet, do they? What about, I like baseball. So then, well, that's about another $5 per month. Okay, well, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? We're seeing the unbundling doesn't save you money.
No.
We always warn people, you want more channels than you think you do. And my capability is still too high.
Also true. Now, like Warren Beatty, Barbara Streisand is one of those stars who doesn't like to be rushed. She dallied with directing a film version of The Normal Heart for years and years and years and years. It drove Larry Kramer crazy. And Larry Kramer is already pretty much crazy. Another project.
And right. Crazy and right. But anyway.
Yes. Another project that Babs had on the back burner is a new movie version of the musical Gypsy, with, of course, Streisand starring as Mama Rose, the Hamlet of musical theater roles for women. Now, that project is heating up again with Barry Levinson set to direct and Streisand. She's going to, of course, star. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Oh, okay.
I mean, seriously, she's 73. I mean, she cannot play Mama Rose. She is way too old. She could do it on stage in a concert production for one night. She could even do it maybe in a run on stage in a film. It's ridiculous. She'll be Grandma Rose.
Yeah, that's
Granny
true.
Rose. I mean, and Barry Levinson directing. This is how they're making it happen. Yeah, his last hit film was Wag the Dog back in 1997, and he has never directed a musical. What makes anyone think he is ideal for directing a film version
of
Gypsy?
Barry Levinson?
Yes.
His last film was
Okay.
All right. That I'll give
you. Since he's had a hit.
All right.
And he's never directed a musical. Why would he be the guy to do this? This is just a disaster. It literally cannot happen. I had friends who said it won't happen. There's no way.
I agree with you.
Ridiculous.
But speaking of disasters, let's talk about the Golden Globes. Remember that hilarious laugh riot, The Martian? Remember that movie?
Oh, yeah. I loved it. Funny.
It starred Matt Damon and won the Golden Globe for Best Comedy. That's right. Well, it sparked a rules change by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, who couldn't ignore it anymore, I'm sure. In future, they urge people to submit films and TV shows in the category that best reflects the movie or TV show's overall tone or mood. If a studio gets clever by submitting a drama like The Martian in the comedy category, a vote by 2/3 of the members would be needed to overrule that and change it to the category they consider appropriate. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, Well, it's a big whoop, of course. In the scheme of things, it is kind of hard sometimes to say what category a TV show should be, comedy or drama. I empathize. We see it all over the world for everybody. It's just an ongoing problem. Is it a movie? Is it a TV show? Is it a miniseries? Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? But sometimes you know when it's wrong. Here it's weird. It seems like they're just going to have to vote on every single thing submitted. I don't see how that could possibly be. But, you know, because there would have to be hundreds of votes for every year, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of votes. It doesn't say like if somebody complains or whatever, it just says they'll all vote on whether to accept it in a category. And if 2/3 say no, it gets moved to the other category. That's right. How it seems to be working. But that just seems onerous to me. I mean, how many TV shows submit to the Golden Globes? But I guess they'll figure it out.
Are you ready for some football? Why are we doing this story? Huh? Because, you know, that football is going to be on Twitter. Yes, the NFL is coming to Twitter. Of course they are, because, you know, now it's only old people that use Twitter, apparently, after this weekend. I've learned Snapchat is the new Twitter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it paid about... Yeah,
actually, it's the old... Something is the new Snapchat, but anyway.
Yeah. Sure. Twitter paid about $1 million a game for the right to live stream 10 contests showcased on Thursday Night Football. Twitter beat out Facebook, Verizon, and Amazon, but bid less. The games will be available free worldwide. Big deal. Big whoop.
It's a big whoop, and that's a big deal. Like, nobody even thinks twice about all these platforms where all this stuff is available. They just want football in front of your eyes somewhere. And Facebook lost out. Facebook and Amazon were trying to get Thursday Night Football. I mean, that's just a crazy new world that we live in.
That's true. I can't wait for Wednesday Night Football and Tuesday Night Football, because you know that's coming.
Oh, yeah.
You've already forgotten about it, but American Idol ended its 15-year run as one of the...
What's this? I never heard of this. What is this?
American Idol?
Oh, right.
15-year
right.
run, yeah. It's one of the biggest, most influential hits in TV history. You probably remember saying that.
I was backstage at season one. I said to my niece, oh my God, are you okay? She said, why? I said, well, you've never been in a world where there wasn't American Idol. And she said, it's over? I go, yeah. She goes, you mean like for the season? I go, no, it's over for good. She goes, it is? I'm like, well, there you go. That tells you something. She didn't even realize it was over for good. That's how far it has fallen in visibility.
You know what she said right after that? She took a picture of the TV during the episode and then Snapchatted it. Now, American Idol did it in the head-scratching fashion, crowning Trent
as what? The winner.
Yes, that's right. I know you picked the other gal, right?
LaPorsha. Yeah, the gal. Careful there. A little catty there.
No, the gal, I said.
Yeah, you said the other gal.
Oh, is LaPorsha not a girl?
That implies Trent is a girl, too. The other gal. There's only two people. One's a man. One's a woman.
Okay.
Unless you're making some sort of Clay Aiken comment, not the kind of words you want to use.
No, I was just... Look, I'll be honest.
Keep going.
I didn't watch the darn show, okay?
Well, there you go.
So, Michael, you picked LaPorsha, who's the girl, not Trent, who's the boy. You loudly declared it last week or week before that she was a lock to win it all. And in fairness, by the way, so did every other critic. The show hit a 3-year high for the finale, but those 13 million viewers weren't a patch on the 30 million that watched the show every week during its peak. Producers and everyone else involved made so many hints, it was obvious that the show will likely be back in some form before you know it. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, this is still the number 2 series on Fox.
Yeah.
Number 1 is Empire. Number 2 is American Idol. Fox has a lot of work to do. That's a lot of hours to fill up in the winter, and they got to get to work and do it. So it is a big deal. The show will be back. Hopefully, they'll wait long enough that we'll actually be looking forward to it coming back. If it's like within a season, it will be really tiresome.
Yeah, it'll be kind of predictable, actually.
Yeah.
Well, okay, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And here's how this story will affect you. Don't pay anybody to go to an acting workshop, for Pete's sake.
Or like to get your headshots done because he wants to be your agent. But first, you got to get headshots done. $500. Go to my friend Joe. Don't pay anyone when they say you can meet big producers and pitch them your screenplay. Just don't do it. When people try to make you pay to live your dream, it's not a good idea.
However, you should pay us to listen to the show.
Absolutely.
Especially if it's your dream.
Ask.
Yes, we don't, actually.
No,
we probably should.
So what are we talking about here? We're talking specifically about acting workshops.
Well, an acting workshop, Michael,
right.
You may know, is where you pay $200 to $85 or whatever. to, I don't know, get tips on auditions, practice in front of experts who probably aren't paying attention because they're too busy Snapchatting. And most importantly, they promise that some big producer who, or casting director or whoever it is from some big hit TV show will actually be there, or whoever this is who has cast shows like it in the past, they're going to be there and they'll get to see you and they'll totally remember you the next time they're casting their big television show or movie. That is not true at all. They're not going to remember you at all.
Well, that's not true. I mean, some people do get jobs through this, so it's not pure evil, but it is essentially paying to audition. And that's the problem. The acting workshops probably started innocently enough. You know, they've been around for a long time. They've been around for years. But, you know, it's just basically you're paying to be in the room where the guy who casts, you know, the Big Bang Theory.
Are you trying to say people are paying to be in the room where it happens?
That's right. Exactly. And so it's just become sleazier and sleazier. And it finally came to a head. It finally came to a head. What happened? Well, it came to a head years ago. In 2009, California passed a law, the Krikorian Talent Scam Prevention Act. This legislation specifically outlaws workshops and casting directors from charging or attempting to charge an artist for an audition or employment opportunity. You can't pay just to get a chance at getting a job. But that law was enacted in 2010. Nothing has happened. No prosecutions. Most of the time, of course, they don't say specifically, give me $50 and I'll let you audition. They say, attend our workshop. You get experience. You'll get to practice. You'll learn tips and you'll meet somebody who's actually done it. So we have experts who actually work on this show on CBS or ABC or NBC or Fox. And so they don't say, give me $50 and you can audition. So the problem is it's just gotten a little sleazier. They passed this law in California, didn't really prevent the problem. And now it's really boiled up. Scott David, he's the head of casting on Criminal Minds, huge hit show. He was fired from his job because of acting workshops. And in fact, he was running the company that did a lot of them. So he didn't just like participate. He was like the owner of them. I don't know what his stake was or exactly, but he was profiting big time from it. And apparently, you know, a lot of the casting people do get involved in these, you know, but he got fired from his job because he was doing this. That meant a casting person on Vampire Diaries canceled their involvement in a workshop. Suddenly it's making big news and the Casting Society of America is getting involved. They set up a panel. They're going to look into it. They're going to see what's going on. They're going to give rulings and advisement to everybody. So stay tuned for that. So what's going on? What happened?
By the way, I would like to make an announcement that my acting workshop for this weekend has been canceled.
Right. Why is that? Why are there casting acting workshops in general? What's going on?
I'll tell you why they're doing it, because there's kind of a
money to be made.
Right. And there's a hierarchy in every industry and every section of the entertainment industry. In casting, you don't just jump into being the head casting director. There's casting associates. Think of them as assistants. They're the ones that get all
the head. Well, not assistants. No, casting associate is a much bigger job than that.
Well, that's true. There are casting assistants. Right, that's true.
Casting associate is a much bigger job. That's a real powerful job.
That is true. And I knew the second those words left my mouth, I thought, oh my God, we're going to hear from every casting associate.
Casting associates have assistants.
That's right. That's true.
If you have an assistant, you're not an assistant.
That's true. So, yeah.
But there are big people on shows who are casting associates. They don't make a ton of money.
No, not at all.
Anybody, right. And casting is seasonal, just like everything else in the entertainment business. It's freelance work for the most part. And so, you know, unless you're a really big casting director on a really big show, you know what? You're trying to get by. And so when someone comes to you and says, hey, just meet with these people at this workshop, we'll pay you to show up. You give them tips and pointers, tell them what it's like to audition, you know, tell them what the experience is like. You know, hey, you know, what's the harm?
Right. But if the Casting Society of America, the CSA, if they really wanted to do something about this, what they could do is interview these associates and then put it on their website and put educational material on their website.
They're not trying to educate people about it. This isn't the point. They're just trying. They know that people are doing this and they're trying to justify it. Because what happened is they formed a new committee to look into this. But none of the people who are actually upset about this and think it's unethical and think casting people should not do it and that they should say this is wrong, none of those people are on this committee. So basically, the Casting Society of America is putting a bandaid on the problem. They're ignoring the fact that a big person just lost their job on Criminal Minds. They're ignoring the fact that laws have been passed to try and stop this. They're ignoring the fact that it looks sleazy and is kind of sleazy. And they're just trying to look the other way because they know some people need it to get by and make money. They don't want to roll the, you know, they don't want to, you know, stir things up. They got a lot of people in Casting Society of America who do it. And so they're not trying to tamp down on it because they're trying to, you know, make it, well, we're just trying to educate and inform people about what auditioning is like. No. People are making money on the side. You're paying to audition to be in the room and it's sleazy and it should stop.
Well, I mean, look, you want to talk about sleazy. It used to be that you just had to like sleep with the casting directors. Now you actually have to pay them too.
That's right. Yeah, and you know, I'm sure there are people who. It's not everybody who does this is evil. There are associates and assistants and casting directors who like go in there with good intentions. People meet with students groups. They meet with actors. They do people all the time. They get paid for their time. That's all cool. But you can see how this has evolved into something sleazy. You can see how it looks. I know casting people, some of them are like, yeah, you know, I've never felt comfortable doing that. You know, they don't do it. They'll go speak to NYU students. They'll go speak to people and other. But that kind of makes them feel uncomfortable, even though it's true. Sometimes casting people see someone in one of these things and they go, oh, I actually need a left-handed person who speaks Farsi for this role. And they remember that person. People do get jobs from it, right? You talked about script writing people who got jobs, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, because those are like pitch fests, right? Where, you know, you're paying to pitch.
Or right, so it's, again, yeah. Another sleazy thing that there are success stories. But in general, it's not a really good idea. You're trying to make it in the industry. Don't pay to pitch. Don't pay to audition. Don't pay to have someone represent you. It's not a good thing.
I'm calling my agent right now, and I'm going to tell them that I'm not going to pay them anymore.
Right. I just wish I think the CSA should do more about this. I don't think they care. I think they're trying to, shove it under the rug. And I think it's the wrong thing to do.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll see what comes of it. What comes of the CSA's investigation done by people who have no, I don't know. It doesn't seem like they're really all that interested in investigating it based on who they've picked to investigate it. So we'll see. But that wraps up this week's show, Michael. I know a little long. But we did have 2 weeks, and we did have two big events, CinemaCon and Coachella. So hopefully our listeners learned a thing or two about a thing or two.
Absolutely. And of course, we'll be back next week, won't we?
Yes, we will.
What a change of pace that is.
Well, you mean our weekly show is actually going to be a weekly show?
Apparently, at least for 2 weeks.
Yes. Well, you know, you really don't have to worry about whether there's going to be a show or not in any given week, if you subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can subscribe and you can, the show will just appear before you or before your ears. And again, you can rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. We do appreciate it when you do that because it helps us out and it lets, iTunes know people are listening.
You haven't done it. Most of you haven't done it. Get your assistant to do it.
That's true. You don't have to do it yourself. Just get your assistant to do it or your casting associate. Either one. Links.
Now you're in trouble.
Yes, that's true. Now I'm in a lot of trouble. Of course, that information, how to subscribe to us or how to call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can follow us on Twitters, which is @showbizsandbox. And that's only if you're like 40 years old or over, because let's face it, those are the only people using Twitter these days, from what I now understand. Facebook, if you're 30 years old or over, you can find us at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can also find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That can be found along with all those ways to contact us and follow us and like us on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The one thing we don't have, Michael, we don't have anything for Snapchat. Not a darn thing.
You're old.
I am old. But you know, my new motto is, if I didn't Snapchat it, it didn't happen. Okay, so again,
you say it like it's not true.
Again, our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, who were not at Coachella this weekend, unfortunately. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it is something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
How to podcast workshops. Get in the room with bigpodcastingexperts.com.
Wow. You know what? I think I'm not going to be available this weekend. So yeah, we're going to have to. That's actually not a bad idea. I think we should do that.
That actually isn't a bad idea.
Well, in the meantime, as we put our workshop together, if you really want to bone up on what Michael is covering in the entertainment industry, head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can go to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated, or you can check out his work on bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
hour, under an hour, under an hour.
Impossible.
Go, go, go.
Impossible.
Go.
For the week of April 17th.
Faster.
For the week of April 17th.
We got to get in under an hour. We can do it. Go.
For the week of April 17th, 2016, this is Robin Sambeck.
Hey, Brian, how are you? How was CinemaCon? How was Coachella? Let's do the show.
Okay.
Imagine it. Jungle Book, 240. Batman, 224. Barbershop, 20. Zootopia, 19. I don't even have to say million. Huntsman, 17. Boss, 12. London, 9. We can get to this in 10 minutes. All right, let's try again.